How do you know Sabiha?
From that satsang in the
8:30
of the evening. She's a doctor.
Yeah, I know.
She is into that Nomi.
Master Nomi. Yeah, I met her a couple of times. I met her in California.
And
at the ashram also.
Yeah. I told you to stay.
I know. Krista told us too.
Yeah. Bhagavan said, okay,
you have to be here. This is a Telugu biography of Ramana Maharshi. Written in Telugu, but translated into English. So it's written in the 30s. Mm-hmm. Although they added more to it later on, I think. So he's just telling about some Western devotees who went to Ramana Maharshi. This is one French lady, Pascaline Mollet. Another devotee who was Miss Pascaline Mollet, a French lady, an author of Turn Eastwards. So was Joyce H. Hitting. All these devotees wrote several articles and books on Ramana's philosophy. Chadwick. Mention must be made of Ellen Wentworth Chadwick, who also was a major in the army and who also could not bear the violence of war and went looking for peace. Thus he turned towards philosophy. He roamed about all over and spent some time in South America meditating. Well, they got it all mixed up, really. I don't know, he even came to Canada. He was a surveyor. Then when the World War I broke out,
he
went back to England and volunteered, you know, because he already had gone to some military school, you know. So he was in Western, I think, in Alberta or something, way out there.
Way out there. Where we're from.
I know, but look, this was 1915 or something.
Yeah. It was a frontier.
Nobody lived there. Yeah.
Just a bunch of bison.
I know in 1935 he became a resident at Ramanashrama. His dedication towards Bhagavan was boundless. Initially he used to do Giri Pradakshina, but later he felt there was no difference between the hill and Bhagavan and commenced doing the Pradakshina of the hall where Bhagavan sat. He worked for the publication of English books by the ashram. Not really much. That was so brief. And Louis Boss wrote a 600-page book from England. He did research about everything. Other devotees. A number of Western devotees had frequent darshan of Bhagavan. Some stayed back in India and propagated Bhagavan's teachings. Among them were Maurice Friedman, S.S. Cohen, and Duncan Greenlees. Several German scholars heard of Bhagavan's message and were attracted to it. Dr. Zimmer, a professor at Heidelberg University, developed a great interest in Bhagavan's teachings. He translated into German books such as Who Am I, Uladu and Narapadu, and Crumbs from the Master's Table. He also wrote a biography in German of Bhagavan, but he never went to India, and he died here in New York City. He came to Columbia University.
Oh.
He was a professor there.
He was a visiting professor?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this was must have been in this, what's that famous guy, I'll think of it in a minute, was his student. But he died prematurely. He got pneumonia or something. But he never went to India. He wrote this book, Myths and Symbols of Indian Art. Big, it was collected by, what's his name? I'll think of it in a minute. Everybody, he was a big professor there also. He wrote on mythology. Joseph Campbell. Joseph Campbell was a student. He was a professor of Joseph Campbell. And then when he died, he collected all his materials and put it together, you know, because he was his student at that time, or his professor, probably when he was doing his PhD, you know, he was his advisor. And he put all his books together. Joseph Campbell knew about Bhagavan also. We have a book, you know, scribed by him, given to the father of the ashram here, talking about Bhagavan. You know, the Myths and Symbols of Indian Art, Zimmer's, you know, collected works there.
Oh, that makes sense.
He later migrated to England and took up a job at the Oxford University during the period of turmoil which arose in Germany. See, they don't know what actually happened to him here. Several books relating to Bhagavan were translated into French. In Switzerland, Miss Kepkin, Forbe Kepkin, Olga Forben, I never heard of her, built an ashram to facilitate meditation at a beautiful tourist spot in Casa Gabriella Asconatissim. Ever heard of that? You've been all over. Where Bhagavan Jayanti began to be celebrated. She always wished that someone from Ramanashram should go there and act as a guru. But at Ramanashram, the objective was not propaganda. The ashram felt that seekers should experience the ultimate, something which each one had to do by himself and could not be done through lectures. I don't know, I never heard of this. You know, I know I read this before, but the Swiss lady. Chapter 37, The Present. Ramana's message had spread all over the world. Seekers from all lands would flock to have darshan of Bhagavan and to spend some time in his presence, even after Ramana shed his body. The flow of visitors did not diminish. What could be the attraction of his presence? Now they're coming from 130 different countries every year to Ramanashram. You see a lot of Westerners, especially a lot of Russians, believe it or not. But, you know.
There are a lot of Russians also.
Yes. The reasons for some people's visit was their karma and the bond of attachment of some earlier birth. Once a devotee lamented, "We do not know where we would be in the next birth, or whether we would be able to reach your sannidhi or presence again." Bhagavan consoled him, saying, "Did we get together now without any connection in some earlier birth? Similarly, won't the present association help retain it in future births?" I don't remember that recording anywhere. The first manifestation of Bhagavan's grace is to attract the seeker here. Did not Bhagavan attract Harry Dickman living in a far place? Now that Harry Dickman, I don't think he ever went to Ramana. I met him here, Harry Dickman, in New York, you know, in the 70s. You know, he used to write and correspond to Bhagavan in the 40s and everything.
What was his profession?
He was from Latvia.
Latvia.
And he came to the U.S. But Harry Dickman, he was a yogi. You know, he's a disciple of Swami Sivananda Rishikesh.
Oh, yeah.
But he never went to Ramanashram. But he used to But, you know, I don't know, this is that old Telugu, you know, biography. I don't think they got it all together. To be attracted to Bhagavan's presence is itself the result of merit earned in several births, and should not the present service result in something much better? No one who comes here goes in vain. According to their samskara, they will reach the next higher step, said Bhagavan. I don't remember him. You talk more in absolute terms, you know. Some devotees revealed that Bhagavan himself inspired them to visit the ashram. In 1933, a school teacher of Maharashtra visited the ashram. His experience was as follows. "Why don't you visit me?" said the Swami to him in a dream. "I don't know who you are," was the reply in the dream. "I am Ramana," said Bhagavan. "I have never heard of you. I also do not know where you stay. You come to Madras and make inquiries. I am too poor to undertake the journey. Where am I to get the money from? Go and ask such and such, Seth." Bhagavan named the Seth, the guy, that was his name. After this conversation, the teacher woke up from the dream. He had no acquaintance with the Seth named, but the matter did not stop with words.
Yeah, Seth means a businessman. Yeah. He must be having a name. Seth in general is a businessman.
So this is the Maharashtra up north. On his way to school the next morning, the teacher noticed a jeweler's shop in which the particular Seth was seated all alone. The teacher went in and told him about the dream. The Seth was familiar with Ramana's name, but did not know where the Mahatma lived. Without uttering a single word, he gave the required amount to the teacher, who made the journey to Arunachala. This was something like God himself appearing and forcing a boon. Some, tormented by worldly affairs, reached the presence for consolation and peace. An American lady asked Bhagavan, "Is it all right to kill oneself?" I don't remember this conversation. Being recorded. Bhagavan replied, "If you have the Shakti, all right. Yet how can you kill the self? You may be able to kill the body, but the self cannot be killed. Is it not indestructible? Yet what is the use of killing the body? You may acquire a tortured body. It is only that one with the body experiences heaven and hell. There's another point. The sastras say that the next birth would be according to what one thinks at the moment of death. What if you think of a demon at the last moment?" Now, this conversation, I don't remember recorded anyway.
That's why they name the children the Lord's name.
Yeah.
Because the last breath is
so when they're dying, they think of
Rama come here.
They think of God's name as they're dying.
Yeah,
which is their son's name. But unfortunately, they're thinking about their son, the form of their son. They're not thinking about the form of God or God's presence.
Also, they like Subramaniam, they'll say Subbu. Subbu doesn't mean anything.
The sastras say that the next birth would be according to what one thinks of at the moment of death. What if you think of a demon at the last moment? You could be reborn a demon. Isn't a human birth better than that of a demon? So, even if you give up the physical body, the suffering associated with the body cannot be avoided. The best thing to do is to kill the thought which identifies ahamkara, the ego, with the divine self. So he always used to say about the suicide, you know, why punish the body for the problem of the mind?
Yeah.
You know, it's better to kill the mind or the ego then the problem solved. From some, a visit to Ramanashram became a matter of satisfaction, and for some others, an event to brag about. Lately, Maharajas have been frequenting the ashram. As a result, a visit to the ashram has become a status symbol among the rich and the elite circles. That happened in California. Dang. They used to have all these swamis go there, like Mayor Baba.
Ah, Mayor Baba.
He had a big following in California, you know. So, this is back in the 60s and 50s. And, you know, they used to become like celebrities. Even Swami Vivekananda, you know. Or Swami Yogananda. Hollywood people would go. Some visited the ashram as a place of pilgrimage. Recently, an American lady came all the way from America, spent a few hours in the ashram, and went back the same evening. Bhagavan commented, "Have you noticed her devotion? She felt a mere darshan was more than enough." Some visit the ashram to establish the superiority of their religion. One such was a Muslim who began arguing with Bhagavan. Yet Bhagavan took to answer his questions patiently. The visitor asked Bhagavan, "Has God a form?" Bhagavan, "Who said that God has a form?" Visitor, "If so, is it proper to give him a form and worship his images?" This is a big thing Muhammad went against. He went, they used to worship a lot of images. Each town had their own images and used to go and destroy them. Bhagavan, "Leave God alone. Do you have a form?" Visitor, "Sure enough, and you see it, but I'm not God." Bhagavan, "So you say that you are this body made of flesh, bones, and blood?" Visitor, "It seems so." Bhagavan, "You say so because you see it now, but during deep sleep, you don't see it. So who are you?" Visitor, "Even then, I'm only this. After all, we see it before going to sleep and after the sleep." Bhagavan, "What happens at death?" Visitor, "Then I am dead and buried." Bhagavan, "If you are buried, will you accept it? Why does not the body get up and protest against being buried?" Visitor, "If so, I am not the body. I am the life in the body." Bhagavan, "But till now you thought you were the body, and that you had a form. The dispute whether God has a form or not lasts so long as this ajnana, ignorance, persists. Until you are able to experience a formless I, you cannot worship. You cannot worship a formless God." He never said it like "you cannot." He used to say, you know, it's acceptable. On another occasion, a Catholic missionary began lecturing to Bhagavan on his religion. Bhagavan simply kept quiet. Meanwhile, Chadwick began refuting the missionary's comments on the Bible in his stentorian voice. The visitor stopped his mission. This was Stanley Jones. It's in talks, you know. He wasn't a bishop, a Catholic either. You know, he was a missionary, but he started ashram in India. I mean, he called it ashram, but you know, it's dedicated to Christ and But he was an evangelical. He was trying to convert people to Christianity. And so then Chadwick, he goes going out and argue with Bhagavan, and he said, and Chadwick shouted out from the back of the king, "Jesus said the kingdom of God is within you." and then he started commenting and explaining on it. He said he didn't make any qualifications, he just said it's within you. You know, he shouted at him. And Chadwick's father was a minister. You know, he was brought up in Christian schools.
Yes.
So. His father was a principal of a school also. Mm. Those who go about on this mission are merely satisfied with the molasses, but they cannot taste the sweetness of the cane. They have things sort of jumbled up here. The really cultivated must savor the overflowing peace in the atmosphere of the hall and let their emotional upheaval subside. The power and force of that current of peace, as experienced by several devotees like Humphreys and Paul Brunton, has already been alluded to. In fact, that usually was the initial experience of Bhagavan's grace. With the subsiding of emotion, the establishment of tranquility, a particular thing occurred in the presence. Seekers had several doubts on spiritual matters, but all those doubts simply vanished, as it were. Some even did not have to express their doubts. A lawyer from the Lord visited Bhagavan with a written list of doubts. But in the presence, he could not utter even a single word. Bhagavan himself, out of abundant grace towards him, said, "You may ask." Another peculiar thing happened once. A well-educated Nepali feudal lord visited the ashram. A feudal lord. I heard of this Nepali. I didn't know he's a feudal lord. He was accompanied by his servant, a Gurkha.
Oh,
the feudal lord sat in front of the office and was rehearsing the questions he had to ask Bhagavan. Meanwhile, the servant ran to Bhagavan and narrated those questions in his own language. Bhagavan looked at him silently. The servant ran back to his master and repeated the answers given by Bhagavan, saying, "This is what Bhagavan said." The master was astonished and asked him, "Does Bhagavan know our language?" And without leaving it at that, himself went to Bhagavan and asked him whether Bhagavan was familiar with their language, Nepali or Hindi, I don't know.
Gurkhas are usually from Nepal.
Well, he was from Nepal, you know, the guy.
Mm.
Those present in the hall burst out into loud laughter.
Gurkha is a watchman.
Yeah.
Night, you know,
One of the devotees present told the Nepali that Bhagavan was silent all the time, and that his silence itself gave the replies, and that this was one of Bhagavan's ways of teaching. This Mauna Upadesha, silent teaching, could be similar to what Dakshinamurti imparted to his disciples. In earlier years, there was no practice of reciting the Vedas in Bhagavan's presence, but for some reason, it started, and thus a new phase came up. You know, the priests from the temple used to come in the morning and recite. I think just for the... just because they felt edified by doing it, you know what I mean, in Bhagavan's presence. Those who savored the earlier phase of Mauna must have noticed the difference between the two phases. Evenings, especially the period of dusk, was one where silence reigned once. It could also be described as the meeting point of the Jiva and the Brahman. The Mauna was also interrupted either wittingly or otherwise by some who kept on raising minor points with Bhagavan repeatedly. The reason for this was rather unclear. Either they wished to show off that they belonged to the inner circle of Bhagavan or wanted to know answers straight from Bhagavan for the sake of authenticity. Some of these points related to Bhagavan's life story as already recorded in books, or to their own mundane life, yet some others attempted to show off their erudition. Some others exhibited their musical talents in Bhagavan's presence, perhaps under the impression that he that it was all seva. About the significance and power of the presence, Kavyakanta, Ganapati Muni, used to tell his disciples, Arunachala itself is a chetra, a place of fire. The water here itself causes heat in the body. The land is dry, elevated, and hot. Bhagavan is the personification of Agni. To be in his presence is itself to be in the midst of fire. Those who perform japa in the presence of Bhagavan will feel unbearable burning sensation within. Well, he did. I don't know if others did, you know. He had this burning sensation. The result of any act performed in a sacred place will be pronounced. Similarly for acts performed in Bhagavan's presence. Be cautious in your japa. Transformation of the individual in Bhagavan's presence would always be intense and fast. Those with good tendencies got attracted and their transformation also would be speedy. This also was a manifestation of Bhagavan's grace. It is not possible to describe the grace of Bhagavan when he was silent. By looking at his eyes, one could notice how indifferent he was to the world around him. It was at such moments that the waves of peace emanating from him could be experienced. Also, devotees had various other experiences, like visions, hearing sounds, and even an experience of that nameless and formless state. All these due to the power of the presence. In any case, as all these were purely personal experiences, nothing more can be said of them.
That's Krista.
Krista.
What time is
our
flight?
Oh, it's in the afternoon.
We can go back to sleep. Okay.
Okay. We'll see.
Some, like Paul Brunton, have recorded those experiences.
Wow.
Naturally, a question would arise as to why everyone did not have these experiences. The short answer is that they depended on the individual's latent tendencies. Kavyakanta also is reported to have said that while in the presence, the devotee should not be seated directly opposite Bhagavan lest all their family ties get snapped. Whether Kavyakanta really said so could not be confirmed, but several men who introduced themselves to Bhagavan lost their wives. Don't sit in front. I never heard this before, you know. And it was the other way around also. You know, everyone dies eventually, right?
If you're born, you have to die. Period.
Yeah, there's a lot of strange things in this chapter. It was a common experience of some who came to Bhagavan to lose their close relatives. A lot of people used to die in early, you know, in the early 19th century, or 20th century. Mm-hmm. The mortality rate was pretty high, especially children. In India especially. Average, you know, life expectancy was like in the
30s. 60 years,
65. In the 30s back then.
Yeah.
In the 30s back then, yeah.
Yeah.
Leading to their attachments getting snapped. This was also a manifestation of Bhagavan's grace. Grace by eye contact was rare. Bhagavan's vision rested on some devotee or other for a very brief moment during his mona, silence. It resulted in a tremendous power accruing to the devotee. Sometimes Bhagavan would concentrate that power on someone. Before answering questions raised by devotees, Bhagavan sometimes looked at the devotee closely. At such moments, it appeared to the devotee as if Bhagavan was seeing with only one eye. Like a javelin, a ray would emanate from his eye and pierce the devotee. It meant that Bhagavan scrutinized the inner being and then replied. The brilliance of the vision would be like an electric light in utter darkness. By that grace, all impediments in our sadhana would be removed, enabling us to continue the sadhana. Thus could be described as his greatest grace. This could be described as his greatest grace. This could also be described as his initiation by look, which was more powerful than diksha by touch, initiation by touch, or by upadesha, teaching. This was what was known as guru diksha, initiation by the guru. A few persons among them, Kulkarni of Maharashtra, claimed that they had initiation by touch also. More than Bhagavan's upadesha, through the spoken word, devotees got greater benefit by his silent presence. Yet as Bhagavan himself said, mere presence did not bestow liberation. Once a devotee asked, when is it said, the mere satsang is enough for liberation? Why is any effort on our part necessary? Bhagavan remarked, it is so. The walls and roof of this hall are still there. Should they not have got liberation by now? What Bhagavan meant was that effort of the seeker also was necessary to attain liberation, or moksha. Bhagavan also said that the grace of the guru operates only at the final stages of sadhana. Though the world cannot be held by the sadhaka in the last stages, due to the persistence of vasanas, the self is not experienced. And it is at this stage that the grace of the guru, which really is the grace of the Atman, works and bestows the ultimate experience. It is the same thing that is mentioned in the Katha Upanishad. Bhagavan said that only such a guru could be described as a sadguru. Unlike other types of gurus, he would accomplish the job in a trice. From the above discussion, it would be obvious that Bhagavan's mere physical presence was the greatest grace bestowed on him, or by him. The vibrations of peace and brilliance emanating from that body conferred immense benefits on humanity. There still remained a question whether those vibrations emanated out of Bhagavan's volition or automatically. The results depended on the status of the prarabdha karma of the devotee. Mere contact of the devotee's body with the voluntary vibrations of Bhagavan gave good results in some cases. This was one way in which grace showed itself. Bhagavan himself said that several celestial bodies surrounded a Siddha Purusha, and that whatever was to be accomplished was done by those devatas. Yet in some extraordinary situation, Bhagavan himself bestowed grace by his own sankalpa.
This is all speculation, sounds like, speculative things.
Sundaresha Iyer once wrote a lyric where he said, grace flows from Bhagavan. Bhagavan corrected it, saying, it is not so. It should read, grace is made to flow. But who could guess what those extraordinary circumstances were? It was a common experience of many that several ailments got cured in Bhagavan's presence. All around Bhagavan, everything had to be according to his shakti. There could be no contrariness. And dissonance. And any such contrariness got rectified, and this applied to even physical imbalances, and thus ailments got cured. He called the case of Ramaswami Iyer. A number of persons had vouched that at Sri Ramanashrama their health improved and their digestive power also increased, and that such a thing did not happen in any other place. The influence of the presence extended even to the land. All the foregoing discussion could be of interest to seekers, but for the large number of children, squirrels, peacocks, dogs, and unlettered persons who were very free with Bhagavan, this philosophic points were of little concern. For them, Bhagavan was an ocean of bliss in which they could revel. How can anyone describe that bewitching smile or brilliance of those eyes? They had only to be experienced, not written about. The presence was like Kailasha, the abode of Shiva, Shankara. That was sort of a strange chapter. I don't know if I off did the one. I turned it off. No. What's that?